This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, many questions surround the crash of a Russian charter airliner in Egypt. A big win for Turkey's president and big challenges still ahead. A modern-day tracking learns secrets of reading the path.
I've had several of them come up to me and say, I see where you're pointing, I don't see anything. And that's, I remember those days. I thought the instructor was just pulling my leg and saying, look, it's right there in front of you.
Relationship rumors hit a celebrity couple. Can you say Beyonce? These stories are more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. Senior officials at Metrojet, the Russian charter airline company whose Airbus passenger plane crashed in Egypt, have ruled out any technical failure or human error from the airline. They blame external reasons for the disaster that killed all 224 people aboard, mostly Russian vacationers. Russian transportation officials say the recovered flight recorder sustained only minor damage and have undergone preliminary inspection. A Russian investigator says the Metrojet Airbus A321, which crashed more than 20 minutes after taking off Saturday from Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt to St. Petersburg, broke up in midair after reaching about 9,400 meters in altitude. But Viktor Sorochenko of the Intergovernmental Aviation Committee cautioned it's too early to draw any conclusions. Scott Hamilton, editor of News and Comments of the Seattle-based aviation consultancy Lehman Company, discussed with International Edition's Victor Beatty what the Russian investigator might mean about breaking apart in mid-flight.
There's either going to be a catastrophic structural failure or mechanical failure or perhaps a bomb. It is very, very rare to have an airplane break up at cruise altitude. Now, it's also been reported that in 2001, it had major damage from a tail strike on takeoff or landing. I'm not sure which, in Cairo. So obviously investigators are going to really pay close attention to that as well.
The plane apparently lost contact with air traffic control 23 minutes after takeoff. About what altitude might it be at that point?
I think the reports were that it was around 31,000 feet.
And is it possible that something fired from the ground could bring an aircraft down at that height?
Well, according to the news reports, the ISIS didn't have any missiles that could go above 20,000 feet or thereabouts. That still doesn't rule out the possibility of a bomb that was planted on the airplane. And obviously with this tail strike report, that's going to be a particular area of focus. But with the flight data and cockpit voice recorders recovered, there should be some indication really almost as soon as they have the investigators have a chance to analyze just what those tell you.
Does the fact that the debris is scattered a certain way suggest that it might be a bomb on board, and would there be residue on the aircraft fragments?
Well, there would be residue on the aircraft fragments. I certainly haven't seen enough information coming out of Egypt yet as to indicate how the debris was scattered. It was apparently scattered over a 7-mile area, which obviously does indicate an in-flight breakup. And according to the news reports, the tail section was found some distance from the main wreckage, which suggests that the tail section separated from the airplane. Again, was it something having to do with a structural issue? Was it something having to do with a bomb? We just don't know at this point.
When that Malaysian jetliner was downed over Ukraine, of course, it turned out to be a missile of some sort that was fired from the ground. Would there be any possible similarity between this incident and that one?
Well, certainly not if the missiles in ISIS control could not go above 20,000 feet and the plane was at 31,000 feet. That would suggest that there was something else at work here.
What do you make of several airliners, particularly Gulf carriers, who are avoiding the Sinai until the cause is determined?
I think that's just a prudence, given that it is a combat zone of sorts. They don't want to have a repeat of the Malaysian MH17 shoot down over Ukraine.
Is airspace worldwide still fairly wide open, or does it become more restricted when you have incidents like this?
It becomes more restrictive when you're over combat zones, and there's a lot of restriction over the Middle East right now because of obviously all the combat that's going on there. Airspace is restricted over North Korea. You know, airlines aren't allowed to fly over North Korea, even though that's a more direct route, say, from Tokyo to Beijing. They have to go down and around South Korea to go into Beijing. So there are airspace restrictions, but anytime you have combat, there's additional restriction.
Scott Hamilton, editor of News and Comments for Liam Company in Seattle, Washington, talking with International Edition's Victor Beatty. Most of the bodies of the victims have been returned to Russia. The surprising election results in Turkey puts an end to several months of political uncertainty. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's AK party came out on top. But as Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul, many major challenges await the new government, even with its large parliamentary majority.
Supporters of the AKP party celebrated into the early hours of the morning on the streets of Istanbul. Speaking Sunday, Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu gave a unifying message. He said, let's roll up our sleeves and create a new Turkey in which politics is normalized, in which people greet one another peacefully. The shock victory, which confounded all of the country's opinion polls, was welcomed by the financial markets, with the Turkish lira surging in value as news broke about the result, which ended months of political uncertainty after June's inconclusive election. But major challenges faced President Erdogan's AKP party, including a sluggish economy, a resurgence in fighting with Kurdish rebels of the PKK, and the growing threat of the Islamic State, blamed for the country's worst terror attack last month. The president is also at odds with his Western allies over Syria and the deepening migrant crisis. Analysts say there had been hopes among Turkey's allies that the expected coalition government could lead to the government softening its policies. But with the president's AKP having a large parliamentary majority, the question that both political opponents and Turkey's allies are likely to be asking is how Erdogan will use his party's new mandate. Monday, the president gave a defiant message saying the world must respect the result. A key test will be whether Erdogan pursues his controversial goal of giving himself more power by trying to change the constitution and turning the country into an executive presidency, which observers say threatens to add to Turkey's deep polarization. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
Time now for a look at what's buzzing on social media. International Edition's G. Abby Lee is here to fill us in. Hello, G.
Hi, Ray.
What do you have for us today?
The social media app Snapchat changed its privacy policy, and that's getting a lot of attention on Twitter.
We've talked about Snapchat before on our segment, but let's remind our listeners now what it really is.
Sure, it's a photo and video sharing app that's popular among 13 to 34-year-olds. And more than 60% of that demographic in the United States use it. It also gets about 4 billion views every day based on the company's website.
So it has a younger audience than Facebook or Twitter, and it's growing at a fast pace.
That's right.
But going back to the change in its privacy policy, what did Snapchat say about that?
It all started with this tweet. We are not stockpiling your private snaps. Our updated privacy policy and terms of service explained. That tweet got more than 1,200 shares, and it also includes a link to its website that explains the change.
Okay, so what are some of the main changes we're talking about?
Snapchat is saying that the main change is in the wording because they wanted to make it easier for users to understand. But it also said the company added new language about in-app purchases, announcing they are now selling what's called replays. Last but not least, the company also clarified what info will be available to users to make it easier for people to find each other. On the same webpage, it emphasized that private snaps and chats, which are video clips and messages, remain private.
And I'm sure a lot of people are very relieved to hear about that.
Absolutely. Snapchat is retweeting a lot of positive responses. Like I said earlier, its users tend to be younger, so that gets reflected in the tweets. Here's an example. One user tweeted, I was so worried when I heard about the Snapchat drama at school. But after their explanation, I am back at sending snaps. Another one reads like this. I know it's just rumors. I love you at Snapchat. Hearing about one social media app's privacy policy on another social media platform lets you know that we truly live in a connected world. Ray?
Thanks, G. You can follow her on Twitter at G Abby Lee. That's J-E-E-A-B-B-E-Y-L-E-E. and also by following our program's account at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, the host for Jazz America, where each week we give you the best of jazz past and present and conversation with the music makers. You can hear the program online at voanews.com and on the air on VOA each Saturday and Sunday at 13 hours Universal Time. Join me for Jazz America and help me celebrate the greatness of a century of jazz. Listen at 13 hours Universal Time, Saturdays and Sundays, on voanews.com and the Voice of America.
You are listening to VOA's International Edition. The World Health Organization reports three new confirmed cases of the disease Ebola in Guinea in the week ending October 18th. The WHO says since the beginning of the current Ebola outbreak, there have been a total of 28,476 reported cases in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, with 11,298 reported deaths to that date. Dr. John Dye is the chief of the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases, a viral immunology branch. He's involved with the development of vaccines and therapeutics and spoke with International Edition Susan Yaki about the fight against Ebola.
I don't know if it's a win and lose situation. We're trying to keep up. With this current outbreak in Western Africa, in two of the countries, they haven't had a reported case in at least a month, so that's a great sign. There are still cases in Guinea, and we're still battling. Let's just put it that way.
Well, how are you approaching your research? What are you looking into?
So I work at the United States Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases, which is USAMRID, and that's a mouthful, I know. And for the last several decades, and myself for the last decade, we've been looking at developing vaccines and treatments for Ebola virus and other pathogens of interest that could potentially cause pandemics. So in the past 10 years, we've developed multiple vaccines that we have taken through small animal models and moved them into monkeys, seen protection, and now some of those vaccines that we've been developing at USAMRID and testing are actually being assessed in Western Africa. So there are multiple vaccines that are currently in West Africa being implemented by Merck and Janssen to see if there is any efficacy. On top of that, we've also been trying to develop therapeutics, monoclonal antibodies, and drugs to actually combat the virus, which are currently being investigated as well. So there's a lot going on right now with the therapeutic and vaccine front with Ebola.
So for the layman, does that mean we're pretty close maybe to finding something to help here?
I think we are close. I think we have things in our cabinet that could be effective. The thing about this outbreak is the number of people that were infected and the number of people that succumbed to the disease. Ebola has been around since it's been around long before 1976, but we first learned about it in 1976. And prior to this outbreak of Ebola, there's only been about 20 outbreaks that have occurred. And we're talking about a total of 3,000 to 5,000 people that have been infected. So we haven't had a lot of people to look at to see if vaccines or treatments actually would be efficacious. So a silver lining, if you want to look at it that way, from this outbreak is we have a lot of people to look at. We have a large number of people that were infected and survived. So we actually have a way of trying to assess whether these vaccines or therapeutics work.
That's Dr. John Dye, chief of the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases Viral Immunology Branch. He spoke with International Edition's Susan Yaki. People who use artificial limbs are now able to move with their prosthetics just by using their thoughts. But the bigger challenge of prosthetics is making them feel. Scientists are now working to incorporate the sense of touch into artificial skin that would allow users to feel the pressure of an object. VOA's Jessica Berman explains.
Picking up something as delicate as a strawberry could easily turn the fruit to mush because there's no way to gauge how much pressure is being exerted. So scientists at Stanford have created a flexible fabric-like skin embedded with sensors that work like some of the skin's sensory functions. The results of the study are published in this week's issue of the journal Science. The researchers tested a two-part device. The top layer senses pressure and translates it into digital signals. The bottom layer sends the electrical pulses to nerve cells, which transmit the information to the brain, which recognizes them as touch. In tests, mice were able to register the pressure exerted by the artificial skin. One of the lead authors is Alex Chortos.
The end goal of this would certainly to be to make sensors that can be integrated with the human body in order to make prosthetic devices. So we want prosthetic devices that can feel touch the same way that humans do.
The artificial skin would also be able to respond to the amount of force being applied, noting the difference between a caress and a poke. Torto says researchers hope to go beyond the sensation of touch.
There are a few other things like vibration and temperature and stretching, and those things are good opportunities for future work in this field.
Scientists hope that perhaps in the next 3 to 5 years, they'll be able to create artificial skin that would allow artificial limb wearers to feel sensation from a handhold to the heat of a cup of coffee. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Coming up, modern day trackers. This is VOA.
This is Greenbeat for a healthier planet.
Even domestic animals can become endangered, like the Von cat, for example. This rare breed has been brought back from near extinction by the Von Cats Research Center in Turkey. This white cat was a popular pet throughout the city of Von for centuries, but by 1992, researchers could only locate about a dozen. Dr. Abdullah Kaya is head of the Von Cats Research Center.
Since then, we have been breeding them. Right now, there are nearly 210 cats in here.
What makes this cat so unique is its oddly colored eyes, one amber and one blue. Researchers say the odds of other animals having different colored eyes is 1 in 10,000. For the Von cat, it's 16 out of 100. Here's researcher Nahid Aktash.
This is a genetic problem, but this problem makes them unique in the world.
The Von Cat Research Center now attracts about 20,000 cat-loving tourists a year. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. It's a common scene in detective movies and westerns. The bounty hunter kneeling down and carefully examining the ground, then looks up and knows exactly what direction to go. It's not all Hollywood make-believe. Man-tracking is the art of following another person through wild terrain by interpreting clues left by their passing. Reporter Mike Osborne attended a man-tracking class for beginners and discovered how modern life can utilize this unique skill.
Yes. Come on up, guys. So on each side of this pathway right here, try not to walk through the center of it.
Right here, let's go. And we need one over this.
Somebody over here.
The 20 or so man-tracking students have just been marched into the woods for their first exercise of the morning. Most are already looking a little lost.
All right, coming up through.
Watch for your footprint.
They line up in two rows and arm's length apart, and the instructor walks between them.
That's yours, that's yours, that's yours.
They watch closely as his boots hit the ground in front of them, but when master tracker Levi Montgomery asks them to point out some sign of his passing, they have trouble seeing any evidence of it among the leaves, twigs, and weeds at their feet.
Do you see anything more than this and that?
And I've had several of them come up to me and say, I see where you're pointing. I don't see anything. And that's, I remember those days. I thought the instructor was just pulling my leg and saying, look, it's right there in front of you. And his finger's touching it, and I'm saying, I don't see anything.
Most novices expect to see actual footprints, but Montgomery says that's rare. He explains that wildland tracking is about noticing and interpreting the tiniest of clues, a broken twig, a disturbed pebble, or maybe an overturned leaf. It requires practice and patience.
Slowing my brain down enough and relax from being inner city living to get out into the country and actually start determining the disturbance in the ground. What's the real lay, natural lay of the ground, and what's been disturbed, what's been brought in and changed.
Because that's right here. I see a lot of breaking, like a breaking here, breaking here.
A couple of hours into the class, things are going better, perhaps because the students have now been divided into four-person tracking teams. The team leader focuses on the small clues left by each step. Flankers roam to either side to ensure the direction of travel hasn't changed. The rear observer looks down the trail for more obvious signs of passage.
So stop right there. You see that the light brown leaf faced up?
Right here.
That one right there?
Yes, sir.
Check that and verify that for sign.
Student Jameson Peavyhouse sees real potential in the technique. As emergency management director for a rural county in western Tennessee, he's had to organize search parties for children, hunters, and Alzheimer's patients who wandered off and gotten lost.
Typically, our approach has been to put massive amounts of manpower on the ground and boots on the ground and just try to get, you know, figure out where they may have went and get lucky, basically.
PBL says he won't have to rely on luck once he's formed a small tracking team, a team that can hit the ground running.
And then get on the scene first, and while everybody else is trying to glean information from parents and bystanders, these six-person or eight-person teams will be out there looking the area and trying to find where the track is actually at and trying to keep folks off that track so we can follow it fresh.
Just kind of rotate the end of it down. You put it down there and just kind of rotate the end back and forth in your eye and let your eyes kind of scan. It'll kind of direct where your eyes are going to be scanning.
Hugh Berryman is the host for today's class. He's director of the Forensic Institute for Research and Education at Middle Tennessee State University and a master tracker himself. Tracking is usually referred to as an art, but Berryman believes it will someday be a science.
You know, there's certain things that we use in tracking to determine how long it's been since a person passed a certain area. And it has to do with insect activity. It has to do with plants and how plants respond to damage, color changes and things like that. And there's all sorts of opportunities, I think, for research projects in that.
You got a good one right there, where you went down the moss.
Well, it is good.
Whether art or science, the man tracking classes are proving popular with law enforcement officers, emergency management officials, forensic students, and with the general public. Dr. Berryman and the Forensic Institute plan to conduct four training sessions each year. For VOA News, I'm Mike Osborne in Smyrna, Tennessee.
Made sure that was already stuffed before he touched it, but there's
a new book about the hip-hop mogul Jay-Z and his wife Beyoncé called Becoming Beyoncé, The Untold Story, is fueling the rumor mill with details of an alleged romance between Jay-Z and singer Rihanna. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA's Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee about how the rumor got started and some of its consequences.
So this gentleman by the name of Jonathan Hay was hired by the producer of Rihanna's first single, Pawn the Replay, to do some work, some promotion work, essentially. And so after this book was released, and inside the book, there was some speculation, or it implied that this rumor was made up by a publicist. This gentleman comes forward and says, well, actually, yeah, that's true. I made it up hoping that it would generate some publicity for the song. I just kind of threw it out there to see whether or not it would stick. And by golly, it stuck. So much so that Beyoncé and Jay-Z, and we did not know this at the time, but separated for a year back in 2005, as a result of this allegation.
Now, we should say that Rihanna's representatives, her legal team, and Veda Nobles, who wrote the Pawn the Replay, said, I didn't hire this guy. He wasn't a publicist. He presented himself to me as something, but they're saying, Rihanna's people are saying, this guy was not officially representing her at all.
No, apparently the producer and the publicist had a couple of conversations, and sometimes this happens in the music industry. You meet someone at a party, they say, hey, I can help you. You say, okay, sure, let me know what you can do. And then they go do things to sort of prove that they have the juice, if you will, to make things happen. And so it sounds to me like that's what this is. And what makes the story even more interesting is that this guy now has an artist and he's promoting a couple of his own songs, which he's hoping to have released on Jay-Z's Tidal platform. So this is going to be really complicated for him if Jay-Z and or Beyonce decide to comment on this or decide to do something about it, which they have not.
Okay, now, still speaking of Jay-Z and Rihanna, Rihanna is reported to have inked a $25 million deal with Samsung. And Jay-Z is involved in that, too, is he not?
Right. Now, we may remember that Jay-Z had a huge deal with Samsung to release his Holy Grail album, Magna Carta Holy Grail album, via their platform. Well, it sounds like, and we don't have all of the details now, but it sounds like Rihanna is going to do something very similar because Samsung has a new platform that's, I guess, kind of trying to compete with Apple Music, and it's called Milk Music, actually, and it's a radio service. So what I think may be happening here is Rihanna may have agreed to allow Samsung to release this new album that we've been waiting for forever and ever and ever, called Anti. And it would be a great thing for Samsung because, again, it's a highly anticipated album. And she wants to do something interesting for the release. So this would be it, I think.
All right. If you have any comments, you can send a tweet to Shauna at VOA Lady DJ. You can also log on to our website, voanews.com.
That's it for this edition of International Edition. More news and information on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Everyone wins when girls go to school. For every year of education a girl attains, her future earning potential goes up by 10 to 20%. And because she is likely to share up to 90% of her earnings with her family and her community, everyone around her will benefit. Her children will be more than twice as likely to survive past the age of 5, and they will be healthier and more likely to go to school than will the children of her less literate sisters. Ultimately, educated girls grow into productive women who contribute to their country's economies and help pull others out of poverty. Nonetheless, over 62 million girls around the world are not in school, and millions more are fighting to stay there. Thus, to increase education opportunities for girls, the United States government introduced Let Girls Learn, a program through which a number of U.S. government agencies and non-governmental organizations, including the Department of State, U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR, the Peace Corps and the Millennium Challenge Corporation work together to address some of the obstacles preventing adolescent girls from attending and completing school and receiving high-quality education. Pakistan is one country where girls often find it difficult to attend school. This may be due to lack of funds, because they live too far from the nearest school, or because some within their society disapprove of education for girls, especially once they reach adolescence. That is why the First Lady of the United States, Michelle Obama, and First Daughter of Pakistan, Mariam Sharif, launched the Let Girls Learn initiative in Pakistan on October 22, 2015, at the White House. This initiative will provide $70 million for new and existing education programs that will help educate 200,000 Pakistani girls between the ages of 10 and 19. Educated girls become women who strengthen their families, communities, and countries, said USAID Acting Administrator Alfonso Lenhart. By increasing access to educational opportunities during the critical time of adolescence, this important initiative will be transformative for Pakistan, empowering young women to overcome barriers and lift themselves out of poverty. We look forward to continuing to work with the government of Pakistan and our partners around the world to ensure girls everywhere get the education they deserve.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.